And now for reading and writing and radio.
Milking is going on in the cow barn. The milking machines are making their rhythmic, comfortable swish-pull sound. The cows are munching their grain ration in the same rhythm. Grandpa comes into the cow barn. He waves his arms like a semaphore, cheerfully. "Good morning, ladies," he says to his cows. It is more a shout because he cannot hear. "Good morning. Are you all happy? Are you all giving lots of milk? I appreciate your fine efforts. I know it takes a lot out of you, but keep up the good work. Let me know if there is anything more we can do for you."
The author of that scene from the Round Barn was Jacqueline Jackson, but it could be you. WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
Kids and teachers, today I want to share with you some of my newest writing. The ideas for the Round Barn, though, have been with me for a long time, seeping into my bones all the time I was a kid. That's why I think it's of special interest to all of you as young writers, for your material is seeping into your bones right now. I grew up on a Wisconsin dairy farm with a round barn at the center of it. My grandfather built it in 1911. And I'm telling the story both from my own point of view and from the Round Barns, so that any story that has something to do with the farm can go in the book. I'll tell my grandfather's stories, my father's, my own, my brother's, the milkman's, even a story by a mouse in the barn and a cow. There's a lot about cows in the book. It's a kind of expanded autobiography. Autobiography, you know, is the story of yourself, written by yourself. But in telling this autobiography, I don't start it out, "I was born," and go on from there. I tell it like a jigsaw puzzle. An edge piece here, a center piece next, a piece of the sky, the pig pen, the woods. And sometimes the puzzle piece has me in it, and sometimes it doesn't. But when the whole puzzle is put together, it will be a complete picture, which will tell not only about me, but also a whole lot else. All this is a way of saying that when you write about yourself, you can include lots and lots of things, and that you don't need to start at the beginning either. Today I'll read several puzzle pieces from the book. The first is about my father, Ronald, when he was little and went to a one-room country school just across the field. I've heard this story all my life, but I've made up many details. You'll need to do that, too, when you write a story. Grandpa in the story is my grandpa, my father Ronald's father, and he was deaf. I call him Grandpa because I'm telling the story, so just remember that and don't be confused. It hasn't got a title. Let's call it Fool's Names. Ronald is 7. For his birthday, he has a new jackknife from Aunt Ida. Trevor is jealous. "I want a jackknife, too," he insists. Aunt Ida assures him, "When you're as old as Ronald, I'll get you a jackknife. 5 is too little for one." Trevor has heard that story before. When he is 7, then Ronald will be 9, and Aunt Ida will have forgotten all about the knife. She'll be buying Ronald an air rifle and telling Trevor that 7 is too young for an air rifle. She will get him one when he is as old as Ronald. Trevor knows he will never be as old as Ronald. "Let me use your jackknife," he wheedles. "No," says Ronald. "5 is too young to play with a knife. You'll cut yourself." Ronald uses his new knife at every opportunity. He sharpens sticks, he tries to make willow whistles, he fashions parts for his wagon. One morning at school, he raises his hand. Miss Gillette excuses him, and he goes to the boy's back house. While he is sitting there, his jackknife falls out of his pocket onto the floor. He picks it up, opens it, and begins carving an R on the inside of the door. He stays a few minutes longer than his business necessitates to get a good start on it. At recess, he finishes the R and starts on an O. O's are harder because they are entirely curved. He works slowly and meticulously on the back house door whenever he has to raise his hand during the day, and at lunch and recess. Sometimes he raises his hand when he doesn't really have to go. He is careful not to stay in the back house too long. The other boys are much interested. They envy him his jackknife. They make bets on how long it will take him to finish the name. At last it is complete. The back house door is chiseled out in large, deep block letters, Ronald Dogan. Ronald is satisfied with his workmanship. The boys are respectful. That night after supper, Trevor shouts into Grandpa's ear, "Ronald carved his name on the back house door!" "Shut up, shut up!" Ronald shrills. "What?" says his father. Trevor shouts as loud as he can, "Ronald carved his name on the back house door with his new jackknife!" Understanding breaks over Grandpa's face. He looks sternly and sorrowfully at Ronald. "Ronald, is what Trevor tells me true?" Ronald hangs his head. "I am disappointed in you," says Grandpa. "You will have to remove it. Come along." He takes Ronald's hand. They go to the tool shed. "Select a plane," says his father. Ronald looks at the three planes on the work table. They are all large. They are all heavy. He takes the smallest one. Grandpa keeps a hold of his hand. Together they walk across the plowed furrows of the East 20 toward the schoolhouse. Grandpa takes long strides. Ronald has to trot fast. The plane in his other hand gets heavier and heavier. He cries. Behind them, at a safe distance, Trevor capers and flings taunts. At the back house, Grandpa opens the door. There is the name, Ronald Dogan, in all its splendor. They survey it together. To Ronald, the letters now seem to move and dance, to be red with the licking flames of hellfire, like the printing of the devil's whispers in one of his storybooks at home. Grandpa shakes his head. He says, "Fools' names and fools' faces always appear in public places." He lets go Ronald's hand and stands holding the door steady. Sobbing louder, Ronald begins to plane the letters. On the farm, he has always liked to use the plane to run it along a board and have the sweet-smelling curl form behind and fall off. But he has never planed on a vertical surface before. It is terribly hard. He tries going from the bottom to the top. He tries going from the top to the bottom. He tries going from side to side. That is the worst, for the plane is heavy and keeps slipping. Grandpa gives no advice. Ronald settles on bottom to top, crouching before the door in order to get more shove pressure. The wood curls fall down around his knees. Slowly, very slowly, because he carved them so deep, the letters erase. He has to come at some parts of them from all different directions. The plane is so heavy he can scarcely move it. Often it nicks and chips and is bulky. His arms ache. He cries and cries. He can scarcely see through his tears. Grandpa stands silent. Ronald knows he will not be finished till nothing more can be seen. The swatch he planes gets larger and larger in order to reach the bottom of the letters. Finally, his father says, "There." Ronald gets up, stands back, wipes his eyes and nose with his sleeve. The spot where his name was is smooth and light-colored against the seasoned surface. No trace of Ronald Dogan can be seen. Grandpa closes the door. He points to the mound of shavings left on the ground. Ronald scrapes them up and hides them between the bushes by the fence. Then he and Grandpa start across the field again. Grandpa still holds his hand, but now he walks more slowly, matching his stride to Ronald's, and he carries the plane. Trevor is nowhere in sight. In the middle of the field, Grandpa stops. "Look, there's an oat just starting to come up." He kneels. Ronald kneels, too. A little green sprout is pushing its way out of a furrow. The hull is still clinging to the blade. "It's such an ordinary thing, crops coming up in the spring," his father says. "Yet every time a seed sprouts, it's a tiny miracle. Look down the furrows. All the seeds are pushing up. It was the rain yesterday. Grow, little fellow, croons Grandpa to the oat, touching it gently with his finger. Grow strong and sturdy in the sun and rain. Grow to make feed for the cattle and bedding for their stalls. Grow to do your little bit in the universe. Ronald thinks how little a bit it is, one oat plant. But multiplied by a field of oats, by fields and fields of oats, the granaries overflow, the straw stack is a golden mountain. He does not know why, but his spirits lift. They stand up, return to the farm, replace the plane in the tool shed. Nothing more is ever said about fools' names. The second story we can call the manure trolley. And it's another true story. My brother told it to me. He's Thad. You all know what manure is, cow droppings. But you need to know that the manure trolley is a large, rounded, bottomed, longish tub. It hangs from the barn ceiling on a pulley, and there are wheels on a track. In the round barn, the track goes in a circle. And the barn hands would push the trolley around the barn behind the cows and shovel manure from the gutter into it, then push the trolley into the barnyard, flip it over, and all the manure would fall off onto the manure pile. So here's the story. Thad is 10. His friends bike out to the farm one Saturday to play. They are John Eldred and Ed Gretzner and Jim Hayes. They drink chocolate milk from the cooler. They play in the straw stack. They drink more chocolate milk. They slip around on the corn ears in the corn crib. This time they drink orange. Then they go into the cow barn. It is empty. It is clean and in readiness for the afternoon milking. They go into the center part by the mangers and fill all the cows' drinking cups by pressing down the perforated lip. Thad spots the manure trolley hanging at the barnyard doorway, ready to be hauled into the barn. He goes and hauls it in. "You guys want a sky ride?" Thad asks. Jim and John and Ed look up. The trolley is up high, close to its track. "How can we get into it?" Jim asks. "Follow me and I'll show you," says Thad. By its chains, he hauls the trolley full circle around the barn to where the track starts, just half a foot away from the turn at the other end that sends the trolley out of the barn to the finish of the track over the manure pile. The boys trot along behind the trolley. The start of the track stops the trolley. Thad pulls a chain and lowers the bucket till it is resting on the sidewalk. "Get in," he instructs. Ed is doubtful. "Is it safe?" "Sure," says Thad. "I've done it lots of times. It's fun." "It's dirty," says John. Thad is scornful. "You call a little manure dirty? It's all dry. Do you want a sky ride or not?" The boys climb in. They sit in a row on the curving bottom of the manure bucket, Ed first, then John, then Jim. There is just room for three boys with their knees up under their chins. Thad pulls the chains. The lever system makes it easy to lift the bucket. It starts going up. "Hey," says Ed, peering over the side. The bucket rocks. John and Jim lean the other way. The bucket dips that way. "Don't rock the boat," Thad cries. "Just sit still and you'll be all right. Hang on to the edges. Pretend you're manure." He goes on hoisting. The boys sit still and hang on to the edges. They look dubious. Thad pulls them as high as they can go without hitting their heads on the track. They are quite high. "This is sort of high," says Ed. "Nah," scoffs Thad, "only just don't wiggle. Ready?" "Ready," chorus John, Jim, and Ed. Thad begins to push the trolley. It creaks into motion. It begins to move slowly around the barn. "Hey, this is fun," says Jim. "Didn't I tell you?" says Thad. He pushes harder. The trolley picks up speed. "Hey," says Ed in alarm, "slow down." "It's all right," says Thad, pushing. "It's more fun, faster." The boys hang on tight, scrunching their heads into their necks as the trolley careens around the barn. They don't rock the boat. Thad gives the trolley a final push. It rushes to the end of the barn part of the track and makes a sudden right turn. It banks sideways, taking the turn like one of the airplanes on a chain at the airplane ride at the county fair. The three boys screech. The trolley zips straight out of the barn and into the barnyard. The boys are terrified. They can't see where the track will end. They're afraid the trolley will speed right off the end of the track and crash them to the ground. Ed grabs a lever. The bucket promptly turns over and spills them onto the manure pile. It hangs above them, empty and upside down and rocking gently. Thad is delighted. He whoops with laughter. Jim and John and Ed crawl off the manure pile like maggots off a fish head. They are manure from top to toe. They are not amused. "You can wash in the cow tank," says Thad. "I'm going home," says John. "Me too," say Jim and Ed. "You can have some more chocolate milk," says Thad hopefully. His friends climb on their bikes and start back down Collie Road. Thad watches them as far as Marston's. "Well, anyway," he says, "they can't deny it was a great ride till Ed pulled the lever." The third story is again about Thad and another sort of ride, a 10-cent Ferris wheel ride. This time he is at the county fair with Grandpa, who you remember is deaf, and it's back when soda pop cost a nickel. Thad is 8. It is August. He is at the Rock County 4-H Fair with Grandpa. He and Grandpa are in the grandstand together. They are watching the horse pulling contests. He and Grandpa love the horse pulling contests. They love to watch the great beasts sweat and strain and finally move the immense weights that have been piled on the sleds behind them. The rest of the family are off at other parts of the fair. They do not want to watch the horse pulling contests. Thad has had 50 cents to spend. He has been spending it carefully. He has 25 cents left. After the horse pulling contests, he will ride the Ferris wheel. He particularly loves the Ferris wheel with its view all over the fair and the lurch it gives him in his stomach. He has been saving that treat till near the end of the day. After the Ferris wheel, he will have 15 cents left. A boy comes through the grandstand selling soda pop. The sun beats down on the grandstand. Thad is very thirsty. He knows that Grandpa will not buy him a drink. There is chocolate milk iced down under a canvas back in the car in the parking lot. He has a sudden generous impulse. He will buy Grandpa a drink. Pop costs 5 cents. He points to himself and Grandpa and the vendor and shows Grandpa his quarter. Grandpa nods and beams. He will accept the gift. Thad hails the boy. He feels important and magnanimous as the boy wends his way between the viewers and the long bleacher seats. Thad says, "I'll take 2 root beers." He knows Grandpa likes root beer, although he never touches real beer on account of the pledge he signed when he was a boy. The boy uncaps the frosty bottles and hands one to him and one to Grandpa. "Thank you," says Grandpa. Thad gives the boy his quarter. The boy drops it in the slot in the quarter section of the change maker he carries at his belt. It is like the one the milkmen carry. Then he presses the lever on a different section and gives Thad back a nickel. Thad is shocked. "A nickel," he cries. "I get 15 cents. "Pop is a dime," says the boy. "It's always a nickel," Thad cries, frantic and outraged. He sees the Ferris wheel vanishing from his means. "How come it's a dime?" The boy mumbles something about saving the bottles and redeeming them at a grocery store. He turns away. "Wait, wait," cries Thad. He wants the boy to wait while they drink their root beer and return the bottles to him then and there. He wants his 10 cents refunded now. The boy waits. Thad begins spelling to Grandpa as fast as he can. Grandpa stops drinking his root beer and concentrates on Thad's fingers. In his haste, Thad spells badly and resorts to much gesticulating. Grandpa understands something about 10 cents and not enough. His face clears. He does not wait for Thad's whole story that unless they drink fast, Thad will not be able to ride the Ferris wheel. He thinks the soft drink vendor wants more money. He turns to him and shouts sternly, "Begone, laddie! You've been paid handsomely enough!" With that begone, the Ferris wheel topples. Thad can still see the top of it going round and round to one side of the grandstand, but he knows there will not be another Ferris wheel for him till next summer. He bitterly watches the boy descend to a far corner of the grandstand. He fingers the nickel in his pocket. He regrets his generosity. But Grandpa is so enjoying his bottle of cold root beer that Thad cannot be entirely sorry. When Grandpa is done, he wipes his mouth and says, "Ah, that was just what we needed," and twinkles at Thad. Thad takes the empty bottles and stuffs one into each back pocket. he will return them to a grocery store. The last story is about myself and my father and the cream that wouldn't whip. I call myself Marcy. I'm telling the story in the third person, Marcy says, rather than I say, but it's me all the same. It is Thanksgiving dinner. Everybody is there. Grandpa has said the blessing. Daddy is carving the turkey. Everybody is waiting with watery mouths when the phone rings. It is an irate customer. Daddy slings on his coat. "Where are you going, Ron?" Mother asks. "Mr. Dowd says his whipping cream won't whip," says Daddy, the old curmudgeon. Mother sighs. Everybody sighs. Customers call on Christmas and New Year's and Sundays and late at night and early in the morning. Last month, the family remembers, Daddy drove 10 miles at 11 o'clock at night to deliver a pint of milk to a young mother with a squalling baby. She'd forgotten to order enough milk to make up the formula for the night. Daddy takes a big bowl and fills it with ice cubes. He takes the egg beater and buries the end in the ice cubes. He leaves the house. Marcy grabs her coat and leaves, too. She is interested in seeing an old curmudgeon. She holds the bowl of ice cubes between her knees in the car. Daddy picks up 2 half pints of whipping cream from the dairy cooler. They drive very fast down Collie Road to town. Daddy explains that Mr. Dowd is a widower and has prepared Thanksgiving dinner for his children and grandchildren. He takes great pride in his cooking. They pull up at Mr. Dowd's house. Marcy follows Daddy in the front door, past all the guests, seated at the table in the dining room, into the kitchen. Mr. Dowd is waiting for them. "Look," he says, thrusting the bowl at Daddy. Mr. Dowd has a speech impediment when he is angry. There is a little mound of butter in his bowl, caused by trying to whip the cream with a warm bowl and beater. It didn't whip. It turned to butter and buttermilk. Daddy goes right to work. He dumps the ice cubes in the sink and dries the bowl. He pours a half pint of whipping cream into the bowl. He takes the cold egg beater from Marcy and beats briskly. Mr. Dowd stands and watches, scowling. The egg beater whirs. In a few moments, the cream whips. In a final moment of triumph, Daddy gives the whipping cream a vigorous finishing whirl, so vigorous that the bowl spins off the counter and turns upside down on the floor. Marcy gasps. Mr. Dowd makes a gargling sound and turns red. He can only stutter, "D-d-d-d-d." Daddy picks up the bowl, steps over the mess on the floor, empties the second bottle of whipping cream into the bowl. While Daddy is whipping, the dog comes into the kitchen and is pleasantly surprised by the cream on the floor. He licks it all up so there is not a smidgen left. Marcy takes the dish rag and wipes over the spot anyway for good measure. In a few moments, Daddy has another mound of perfect whipped cream. This time, he omits the final flourish. He takes a spatula and transfers the whipped cream into one of Mr. Dowd's bowls. Mr. Dowd sputters something that might be thank you and disappears with the whipped cream into the dining room. Marcy and Daddy leave. Marcy licks the bowl and the spatula all the way home. They come in. They have been gone a little over half an hour. Thanksgiving dinner is well begun. "Did the cream whip?" Mother asks. "Of course," says Daddy, serving up Marcy's plate. "Our cream always whips." I have many more stories I'd share with you if we only had the time, but now it's time for you to share your personal material with me, bits of your autobiography, the stories that have been passed down in your family, or stories that you've been part of and will tell to your own kids someday. So pour out the cream, get the old egg beater whirring, put in some elbow grease, and watch the cream whip. You think it won't? Nonsense. Your cream always whips.
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.